and follow the principles. Yeah, the finale is these variations of the on the Ukrainian theme, which is very much done in the traditions of the Mighty Handful. But at the same time, there was, of course, a rivalry already being established between Moscow and Petersburg, because Tchaikovsky, as he was coming into prominence, he became a direct rival to the Petersburg group and to Rimsky-Korsakov in particular, who was a similar age, yeah, and sort of similar point in their career. So, and in fact, you know, the further you go, the more their paths diverge.
And Rosamund, picking up on that point, as Marina implied there, Moscow was getting going as a city. So in a wider cultural sense, what was happening at the time in 1875?
Well, it was still a really exciting time in Russian culture and society generally at that point. This is the reign of Alexander II, who is known in history as the Tsar Liberator, because he was the Tsar under whom the serfs were emancipated in 1861. And Tchaikovsky had grown up under the reign of the very repressive Nicholas I, who died in 1855. And the death of Nicholas I coincided with the debacle of the Crimean War, which was a complete fiasco for Russia and showed that Russia really had to reform. And the first thing that had to be reformed, of course, was serfdom. And so this period of the 1860s was the time of the great reforms, and it carried on to a certain degree into the 1870s. But already in 1866, there had been an attempt on Alexander II's life because things didn't go far enough. Nevertheless, this was an incredibly vibrant time in the arts, because Alexander II relaxed the censorship, which had been very, very strict under Nicholas I, and so many new things started happening. There was the foundation of the Russian Musical Society, the brainchild of Anton Rubinstein in 1859 in St. Petersburg. This was the first organization to hold concerts throughout the season in St. Petersburg. It was followed by one in Moscow. And Rubinstein fought to found a conservatoire in 1862. And in this new climate of new things, it became possible to do that. And Anton Rubinstein was able to persuade Grand Duchess Yelena Pavlovna. In fact, she actually sold her own jewels, I think, to put some money into the enterprise. And it was a way of raising prestige for music and for composers, because in the society of the time, you had to have a rank in society to be someone, and there really wasn't a rank then, of course, for a professional composer, as there was in the arts. And so the foundation of the conservatoire in St. Petersburg, which was then followed by one in Moscow, made it possible and attractive for the first time to actually follow a career of composer. And Tchaikovsky, of course, willingly followed that. He was one of the very first students, so he was able to benefit immediately after graduating from the Imperial School of Jurisprudence. He decided he wanted to have a musical career. And, of course, he was immediately given a job in Moscow in 1866 when he graduated for the new conservatoire there. And in Moscow, there was also a lot of great things going on, because Moscow had always been the industrial powerhouse of Russia. Unlike Petersburg, which was the capital city, it was the city of government, it was the city of army officers and bureaucrats. And Moscow was where the money was made. That's where all the oligarchs of yesteryear made their fortunes. People like Tretyakov, who made a lot of money in the textile industry and were also great philanthropists and founded galleries. So one of the first portraits of Tchaikovsky was at the commission of Tretyakov. So Moscow suddenly started to open up, because they began to build railways at this time, and all the railways converged on Moscow because of its industrial importance. And people after the emancipation who'd been impoverished started moving moving to the cities, and invariably they started moving to Moscow. So it was a very exciting place for Tchaikovsky to move to, in fact, and the musical life began to perk up. Moscow had always been a sort of backwater, a sort of Balshaya Derevnya, as they called it, a big village. And that began to change very dramatically in the time that Tchaikovsky was living and working at the conservatoire.
And Rubinstein, as you mentioned, created the conservatoire. His brother Nikolai, as well, very influential on Tchaikovsky's career. But it did, Marina, prove to be a testy relationship, didn't it? He was also one of Tchaikovsky's severest critics at the time, as I mentioned at the beginning.
Yes, and actually both Anton and Nikolai, you know, there was a difficult relationship with both of these brothers, who were, of course, you know, both had colossal genius, especially Anton, who was such a wonderful pianist. He was also Tchaikovsky's composition teacher at the conservatoire. And this was actually one of the problematic aspects in Tchaikovsky's relations with Mighty Handful, because they didn't like conservatory education because it was so Germanic. You know, they were thinking of Rubinstein as Germanic composer and Germanic teacher. And therefore, you know, because they were studying forms there, you know, based, say, on Mendelssohn or something like that. So Tchaikovsky as a conservatoire composer was a very different makeup, in a sense. You know, he studied theory, he studied counterpoint. And the Mighty Handful people, they were really sort of self-taught, taught by Balakirev, sort of hand-to-mouth education. It's very interesting that at this very period, Rimsky-Korsakov also decides to undergo this course of self-study. He's starting writing fugues, yeah, and Tchaikovsky approves of this. Yeah, so in fact, he feels that he doesn't have enough of this technical baggage that Tchaikovsky already had. So that's an interesting thing. Now, of course, with Rubinstein, with the other Rubinstein, Nikolai Rubinstein, who was also a wonderful pianist and a friend of Tchaikovsky, and actually his landlord for during his first Moscow years, for a very long time, he actually lived in Nikolai Rubinstein's flat. And when he wrote this piano concerto, and this was the previous year, he was hoping that Rubinstein would premiere it. And there was this great story about Tchaikovsky showing the concerto to him and getting absolute silence in response. And he was so hurt by this. He says, you know, like you cook a dinner for someone and get no response whatsoever. And when he was trying to get something out of him, Rubinstein just said, you know, it's awful. It's, you know, it's trite. The melodies are trite. The passages are awkward and unplayable, and so on.
But I mean, what fascinates me is that he was practically driven to suicide. If you read the letters, I'm not sure how much that was made up and how much it was true. But
yeah.
But clearly, this symphony is not a gloomy piece, is it? There's a lot of joy in it. Even the funeral march in the first movement is rather jolly.
Well, there are two things here. You know, one thing. You know, when you say Tchaikovsky was driven to suicide, you know, he wrote these very sort of passionate letters, impassioned letters, you know, but that doesn't mean, you know, every time that he was really going to do it. It just, you know, he was a sensitive man, and of course this was a great, great offense to him, and he suffered. You shouldn't also, you know, draw direct parallels between what he was feeling and what he was writing at the time, because of course, you know, you can be go through a personal crisis, but you can write joyful music. He's a professional composer. You know, aesthetic emotion is not the same as personal emotion.
So let's just talk a little bit more about the Third Symphony itself. It is known as the Polish. That's the nickname that was given to it, not by Tchaikovsky, but some years later. It's not particularly Polish. You were mentioning the German influence, both of you. Where does it come from? What are the influences?
Well, it's not Polish in that, despite having a polonaise, this is something that was part and parcel of Russian music by that stage. And when we listen to Chopin writing a polonaise, he's definitely writing it with sort of a nationalist impulse. But if you go and listen to Glinka's Life for the Tsar, you'll find a polonaise in there. And in fact, I just mentioned earlier the first assassination attempt on Alexander II in 1866, and Tchaikovsky went to a performance of Life for the Tsar, and when the Polonaise came around, it was enough for the audience to get up and start saying, you know, down with the Poles, and they demanded the national anthem to be sung 20 times. And the Polonaise was part and parcel linked to the Romanov dynasty. It was linked to the court. It was a stately dance. And in a way, there was something rather aggressive, I think, almost, about Russians using Polonaise. It was almost sort of like in your face, you know, we've taken it over. It's not Polish anymore.
And, I mean, Marina, he talks about the second movement being in the German style. And really, the influences, it seems to me, are very strong from Schumann.
Yes, that's true. When Tchaikovsky was really only trying to find his proper symphonic route, so to speak, and one of his models was Robert Schumann. And in fact, Robert Schumann's symphonies were incredibly popular in Russia at the time, and they were considered, you know, a model of symphonic work. So there are a lot of correspondences there. There's something else as well, which I think I might have discovered, but I might be wrong about that. The second movement, yeah, is called Alle Tedeska, so in the German manner. And I found a possible model for it, which is in Robert Folkman, who was a friend of Schumann. And now we don't know who he was, but actually at the time, his first symphony was played in Russia quite a lot. And Tchaikovsky, you know, doubtless knew it. So it's actually a very similar waltz in the same key. You know, there are quite a lot of similarities. And that might explain why a waltz, and it is really a waltz, is called Alle Tedeska, because it comes from a German source.
And, of course, the theatre was getting going, too, in Moscow. And I think I'm right in saying that as he was writing this symphony, certainly Swan Lake was bubbling away in his mind. So was theatre becoming a very important part of Moscow life?
Very much so. It was part of life in St. Petersburg, too, of course, where he'd been educated. And it's striking that two of the events which made a huge impression on him when he first moved to St. Petersburg from the provinces. He was born out towards the Urals, of course. He moved to St. Petersburg to be educated when he was 10. And he went to a performance of Glinka's Life for the Tsar. And he also went to a performance of Giselle. And both were huge importance in his life. They also had a branch of the Imperial Theatres, of course, in Moscow, although the standard of performance wasn't quite as high, and the Imperial Italian Opera had its main base in St. Petersburg. So Tchaikovsky saw as much as he could, and actually he was a great supporter of the Russian opera that was available at the time, which wasn't very much. And of course, these are all new genres. You know, very little symphonies had been written before Tchaikovsky started writing them. Rimsky-Korsakov was writing, Baradin was writing, Balakirev wrote a little bit of symphonic music, but this was a new genre, and the same is true of opera. So Tchaikovsky was going to the opera and beginning to contribute, of course, to its repertoire as well. Certainly, he loved the theatre, and you can sort of hear the dance in this symphony in particular. You can just feel him just launching off to writing for dancers. And of course, he would totally transform ballet as a genre, because it was such a sort of hack thing to do to be a composer for the ballet until Tchaikovsky. He was a great genius in that respect.
If I may, just to continue a little bit about the ballet, yeah, because it's interesting because he got a commission for the Swan Lake at the beginning of the summer of 1875, and he didn't start composing it until August, but he started composing the Third Symphony, and you can imagine that his mind was already in the balletic frame, because all of these things, like a march, a waltz, a kind of Russian dance that you also hear in the first movement, a Polonaise, of course, you know, they're all very much connected to the music of the Swan Lake. And even if you go further to the Sleeping Beauty, there is an apotheosis there, which is very similar to the apotheosis in the final movement of the symphony. So it's all very danceable. And when this symphony was played, I think it was the 7th of November, 1875, it did have a good response. Tchaikovsky was slightly lukewarm about it. I think he said, well, they're not really good scenes there, you know, although, you know, I like this movement, not like that. He was very self-critical. And I think a lot of people would consider this symphony atypical for Tchaikovsky, just because he wrote another three wonderful symphonies after that, you know, and this eclipsed the third a little bit.
It certainly helped to put him on the map, Rosamund, and he even came into the orbit of Planet Tolstoy, I gather.
Well, he did, actually. This is such an interesting period for Tchaikovsky. He's on the cusp of becoming not just a famous Russian composer, but a famous composer outside his country as well. And it's striking that someone like Tolstoy, who was sitting in Yasna Polyana, he was busy writing Anna Karenina at this time, and he didn't have that much interest, really, in contemporary music. He was almost totally unaware of what Mussorgsky was doing, for example, even though it was quite sort of similar to his own aesthetics. But Tolstoy demanded to meet Tchaikovsky, which is very unusual. He came to Moscow one day and basically sort of refused to go away from the conservatoire until he was introduced to the composer. And Tchaikovsky was a very shy and retiring person. This comes across again and again in his letters. And it wasn't just because he was a little bit tortured by the fact that he was gay and it wasn't easy to be gay in pre-revolutionary Russia. It's because he was just a very private person and he thought, ooh, I've got to meet this really famous writer. But he couldn't get out of it. And Tolstoy almost sort of pinned him against a wall and started haranguing him about what a bad composer Beethoven was. And that was so offensive to Tchaikovsky. I mean, they had nicer conversations after that, but Tolstoy, I think he fancies himself as a specialist. He even wanted to share with Tchaikovsky some Russian folk songs, which Tchaikovsky immediately saw weren't very interesting, in fact. And he was a very sentimental man, so he loved the folk song in the first string quartet, which was performed specially for him. So Tchaikovsky had a few conversations with him, and he had many opportunities actually to meet Turgenev in Paris, but sort of shrank from it. And the only other really interesting writer whom he had some contact with was Chekhov, actually. And actually, he went out of his way to meet Chekhov, who, like himself, was quite a sort of shy and modest person. And they had a wonderful brief friendship, in fact, and that was a sort of mutual admiration society.
Well, there we must draw it to a close. May I just thank both of our guests for their time this evening, Marina Frolova-Walker and Rosamund Bartlett. Thank you very much.
That was Ian Skelly with this afternoon's Proms Plus event looking at Tchaikovsky and his world just over the road from the Royal Albert Hall in the Royal College of Music's Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall. Well, welcome back to the Albert Hall. I'm Sarah Moore-Peach. Tonight's concert continues now with Tchaikovsky's Third Symphony. I'm still joined by Maxime Tourtellier. Max, you are the young associate conductor of the orchestra. Let's talk a little bit about this piece. Kirill Karabits was telling me earlier that one of the exciting things about Tchaikovsky's Third is that it's the one that not everyone believes is particularly great or has that many authoritative recordings of it that everyone is, you know, really, really attached to.
Yes.
For him, that's a really exciting thing.
Well, I can understand why. I think he's right. Even actually when it was premiered, I think it was the least warmly received of the six symphonies, and somehow it has kept this sort of status up to this day, which in a way gives Kirill and the orchestra a great card to play, a great asset, because they're going to try and show how much it's worth all the other ones, especially 4, 5, and 6. I think you will find in each of the five, not four but five movements, bits that will, if you're familiar with Tchaikovsky, that will remind you, oh, this reminds me of a place in the Fourth Symphony or in the Piano Concerto. And I bet if you listen carefully to the fourth movement, you'll feel transported to some of his ballet music, especially the Nutcracker. So it's got all the good bits, and it's there for us to enjoy.
And you, in your work with Bournemouth, you were saying earlier, you work with Kirill Karabits. There was a really funny moment earlier on where Marin Alsop, previous principal conductor,
yes,
of the orchestra,
of course,
who's at the Proms on Saturday, was here listening to a bit of the rehearsal, and she and Kirill were talking on stage afterwards, and he said, you know, that's the first time we've ever met, because we've just never managed to be in a room together. I mean, conductors don't really hang out together, do they?
No, I think it's a very solitary profession. And even I, as the conductor in association, I get to see Kirill during rehearsals and during the breaks, but it goes incredibly fast, and we rarely have time to have the odd drink or so, because, I mean, especially his fault, because he's got such a busy schedule.
Well, Kirill Karabits is going to conduct the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra tonight, making his way on stage to the Royal Albert Hall. He's just coming from his dressing room through the Bull Run and out onto the stage. My thanks to Max Tortelier for joining me tonight. Let's hear Tchaikovsky's Third Symphony, the so-called Polish Symphony, the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Kirill Karabits.
Thank you. Thank you.
masterful performance of Tchaikovsky's Third Symphony, the so-called Polish Symphony, given live here at the BBC Proms by the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra and their principal conductor, Kirill Karabits. Kirill Karabits told me earlier that's not only his favourite Tchaikovsky symphony, at the moment it's his favourite symphony of all. The sort of runt of the litter of Tchaikovsky symphonies as far as everyone is concerned, so it gives him such pleasure to bring it to light. And in front of these thousands of people in this packed Royal Albert Hall. That performance, part of a complete Tchaikovsky symphony cycle at this 2013 BBC Proms season. There are two more to go before the end of the Proms. The first symphony, the Winter Daydreams, is being performed on the 2nd of September by the Oslo Philharmonic Orchestra under Vasily Petrenko. And then his last one, the 6th symphony, the Pathétique, is on 2 days later on the 4th of September, the BBC Symphony Orchestra and Osmo Vanska. Kirill Karabits was the artist on Radio 3 today, picking three recommendations of pieces of music to listen to. One of them was Shostakovich. Another, which I played on The Breakfast Show, was Chick Corea from his Return to Forever. Eclectic musical taste. And you can listen to them again through the Radio 3 and Proms website. And tomorrow's artist is Charles Dutoit. I'll be playing the first of his three recommendations on Breakfast tomorrow. Kirill Karabits is bringing each member of the wind section, the principals, to their feet, and then the entire section together. Behind them, the brass, half the size they were in the Janacek, which began this program. Splendid, nevertheless, in that Tchaikovsky. Well, that was prom number one this evening. The next one is in about 45 minutes' time. The Talis Scholars, celebrating their 40th anniversary this year, performed the Missa Gloria to the Trinitas by Taverner and music by Gesualdo. So back here at the Royal Albert Hall at 10:15. James Jolly is your host here on BBC Radio 3 between now and then. Over to you, James.
Thank you very much, Sarah. That was Sarah Moore-Peach at the Royal Albert Hall. And there's another chance to hear tonight's prom on Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3. And don't forget that every prom is available for 7 days via the Radio 3 website. And now our feature. In 1962, the Welsh playwright Saunders Lewis predicted the end of Welsh as a living language if radical steps were not taken. His dire pronouncements in a radio lecture called The Fate of the Language kick-started a movement of activism and campaigning in Wales that continues to the present day. These days, the number of people who speak Welsh is statistically no longer declining, and Wales is officially a bilingual nation. In The Dragon with Two Tongues, now on Radio 3, the bilingual poet Gwyneth Lewis presents a personal view of this modern revival of the Welsh language.
This business about saying that we are different because we're Welsh. Different from what? Different from people who live across the border? Different from the English? Different from... in what way different?
Believe it or not, there's a part of the British Isles where large numbers of people don't speak English. Every day they speak a foreign language called Welsh. It is quite extraordinary. I once took some Americans down to Wales. They were quite amazed within 4 hours' drive of the capital of the English language, and they're not speaking English.
I'm one of the people described there as speaking a foreign language less than 4 hours away from the centre of the English language in London. My parents spoke Welsh to me, but I was brought up in Cardiff, where we spoke English on the streets. When people in the rest of Britain learn that I write in Welsh as well as in English, they tend to look at me as if I practice a form of extreme Morris dancing. It may be spoken by a minority of the population, but the issue of language death has much to teach us about global issues which will impinge on us all increasingly.
What fascinates me about Welshness is how you're required to declare your credentials. No one in London says, you know, are you Welsh before you start speaking? They say, you know, who are you?
Simon Jenkins is a writer and broadcaster. His father spoke Welsh, and he lives in Wales for part of the year.
I love to hear Welsh spoken in the local shops, and I try in my rather pathetic way to toss in a few Welsh phrases, and I'm sort of thrilled by that. At the same time, people getting endless notices in Welsh and they forget to send the English version, which happened to me last week. The relentlessness of the Welsh language issue, the fact that huge amounts are spent translating governors' meetings into Welsh, courts into Welsh, whatever it may be, when everybody knows it's just wasting money. I mean, Wales is a country, a language and a culture that doesn't need to have this issue hanging around its head like an albatross half the time.
At a time of devolution in Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland, and the anomaly of England being without a national institution of its own, the Welsh language is a good way to examine what it is to be British today. When do we fly the Union Jack, and when its component crosses of St George and St Andrew and the Red Dragon? Is being British today a question of being ex and British? This is a many-layered subject, and for this programme we're going to take five slices, covering the 1960s to the present day, the grassroots to the global, each containing a spectrum of views on this sometimes heated and divisive issue. Richard Wynne-Jones is director of the Wales Governance Centre at Cardiff University.
I can't imagine there's a family in Wales where you can't actually trace a period where Welsh-speaking parents decided not to speak Welsh with their own children. I still recall my dear nain, my dear grandmother, asking, "Sid my Saesnego?" You know, "How's his English?" You know, to get ahead, you know, you had to get ahead in English.
My parents, for example, came to Cardiff to find work, but met in a social club for Welsh speakers. He commented on her red ankle boots, and someone else told him to stop teasing. Welsh has only been a minority language in Wales since shortly before the First World War. Between then and the 1960s, the number of speakers fell steeply. The first of this programme's five slices, part one, or Rhannu'n as we say in Welsh, could be called Dissent, and it begins with the response to this steep decline by a Liverpudlian Welshman called Saunders Lewis.
Cyn cyhoeddi ystadegau'r cyfrifiad a fi y llynydd ar y Cymru Cymraeg yng Nghymru.
Welsh-speaking Wales had its own kind of 60s revolutionary moment, following a lecture from the most unlikely of sources, Saunders Lewis, who led Plaid Genedlaethol Cymru, which became Plaid Cymru, the Welsh Nationalist Party, led that party for the first couple of decades of his existence and then retired to become a distinguished academic and playwright and literary critic.
Saunders Lewis was a fascinating character.
Historian Tim Williams.
He was a revolutionary of the right. He was actually a supporter of all the far right in the 1930s.
He kind of returned to the political fray in 1962. He gave a lecture which had a galvanising effect in terms of establishing the Welsh language movement.
Williams, Saunders Lewis.
Stand up for your ideas, you don't have to sit down.
And he told the Welsh speakers what they didn't want to hear, which is the comfortable existence that they had was going to lead ultimately to the decline and death of the Welsh language, so they'd better bestir themselves.
What Saunders Lewis is saying here is it will be nothing less than a revolution to restore the Welsh language in Wales. Success is only possible through revolutionary methods.
It was the Welsh version of the May events in France. You know, it was the Czech uprising against the Russians. It was a typical British, rather subdued coup against the not-so-indecent English imperialists. It was our version of student radicalism.
Through most of this 20th century, it declined. But that decline brought into action possibly the most successful group of single-issue campaigners in recent political history.
I would see it as part of a wider sort of global movement at that time.
Ellen Harve Griffith-Jones is director of Mercator, a network for media in regional and minority languages in the European Union.
I'd see it linked to feminism, to pop culture, a growing awareness of the fact that the world needed to change, and it was through the young generation that that would happen.
I thought the campaign for the language was important, but in terms of priority, relatively marginal.
Sir Dayan Hopkin is a historian, educator and president of the National Library of Wales. He was a student at Aberystwyth at the time of Saunders Lewis's lecture.
There was an issue with the decline of a language, and it seemed to me that Cymdeithas yr Iaith was addressing fundamentally that issue. How do you find policies which actually counteract the inexorable decline of the language in so many ways? At that time, that didn't seem to be as important as how do we avoid people throwing nuclear bombs at each other.
What we saw developing in Wales after 1962 was a group called the Welsh Language Society, Cymdeithas yr Iaith Gymraeg, which adopted non-violent direct action methods and was insisting on official status for the Welsh language. So Wales should be visibly bilingual. And so you saw then various campaigns, the most famous of which was related to road signs.
I thought their campaign on the defacing of road signs was wrong and could be a threat to the safety of people on the highways.
And so, you know, I had a few experiences of being arrested and then ended up being imprisoned briefly. That was a case where 10 of us took responsibility for breaking a window in a government office in some protest about lack of Welsh language provision in the education system. And my experience was a very easy one compared to a lot of people. You know, there's a tendency now to romanticise and to make it all big, one big adventure. And of course, you've got your folk songs about taking down the signs and it all sounds like good, clean fun. But, you know, a lot of people had an extraordinarily hard time as a result of their actions.
When I was in school, language protests had a kind of radical chic, like wearing tight jeans and cheesecloth blouses. Tim Williams was a teenage Welsh nationalist in the late 1960s and early 70s. He went to an English-speaking school in the South Wales Valleys and then went on to do research on the decline of the language.
I went into it thinking I was going to find out about the beastliness of the English towards us as a national minority and that they'd beaten the language out of us at school. And I came away with a completely different view that the decline of the language had relatively little to do with education. The English being quite decent towards us, and actually the language died in Wales as much because of the Welsh people and migration. So big forces were operating against it.
The gold ring, symbol of unity, the unity in this instance being the prince's marriage to Wales.
There was a lot of bitterness and hostility. And there were particular moments like, for example, the investiture of Charles as Prince of Wales in 1969, where those things really became quite pointed and quite heated.
Protest campaigns by the Welsh Language Society were phenomenally successful, leading to the increasing adoption of Welsh as a fully official language in Wales, not only on road signs, but on all government forms.
Does the vote?
Pedwar dig now meal.
49,000.
Cant een dig a fimp.
125, that's a yes.
A number of valid votes.
Whereas devolution was defeated decisively in 1979, the gains made by the protest movement, the Welsh television channel, a sizeable increase in Welsh language schooling, and two separate language acts paved the way to the narrow yes vote of 1999 and the establishment of the Welsh Assembly.
26,000. So I think that's a yes all round.
The number of valid votes.
The final finishing post.
Following the kind of nastiness in the late 60s and the early 70s, the idea that Wales could and should be a fully bilingual society, officially bilingual, that was something which had been seen as deeply problematic and reactionary and all kinds of things. And this became normalised. This became, how is that dangerous? In fact, that's good, isn't it? The general mood now is that's a good thing. And I think there is a fear of opening up these issues, lest we return to that period. And it's not helpful because Wales has moved on.
The fact that bilingual signs are everywhere in the public domain in Wales, it makes a visual impact and it changes the atmosphere. For example, I've noticed that many newsreaders in English will pronounce Welsh names not in the old way, like Carnarvon. They'll say Carnarvon, you know, taking trouble to pronounce them in the Welsh way, in fact even exaggerating it, which is quite different. But there are some absurdities of translation. I've never quite worked out in the supermarkets what dovenod for poultry is. I've never met a doven or dovenod in Welsh. And I'm also, as a writer, troubled by the idea of an official language. And we've recently appointed a Welsh language commissioner, and my contrary blood rises against the very idea of a commissioner for language, because I want not to be commissioned linguistically. Lord David Ellis Thomas was the inaugural presiding officer of the Welsh Assembly in 1999 and has played an active role in the language debates for decades.
What an official language means is that it is a language of government, and therefore citizens in dealing with government and in dealing with other aspects of public life, including private business, can expect an entitlement to bilingual service. The very simple one is, of course, the cash point in the banks.
I understood that Welsh was an official language and enforceable as such for public bodies, but that it wasn't enforceable legally for private business.
No, that's changed. The language legislation, which the last Assembly passed, that does have enforceable legal standards for service bilingually, which the language commissioner enforces.
This enforceability is a key issue with regards to language preservation. But nobody reacts well to compulsion. Try telling a child they have to do something and watch them do the opposite.
The campaign for the Welsh language is moving into a different phase.
Geraint Talvan Davies is chairman of the think tank the Institute of Welsh Affairs and has held numerous positions in Welsh public life.
What we're seeing now is the creation of a new organisation, Dyfodol, meaning the future, which is committed to campaigning purely within constitutional means, lobbying, and that's actually a reaction to the existence of the National Assembly and a Welsh government, in that, you know, there is an institution upon which people can act constitutionally.
Ni cheid mohon un iaith swyddogol o gwbl, a byddai trancr iaith.